Hello and welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday, February 9th, 2022. I'm Maggie Lake, here with Darius Dale, founder and CEO of 42 Macro. Hi, Darius.
What it do, Maggie? How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. So is the market today, right? U.S. equities in the green across the board, the NASDAQ extending that rebound for another day. And closing, looks like we're closing with buying right into the close, maybe at the highs of the day, the NASDAQ up 2%. And we see that 10-year Treasury continue to edge back, hovering around 1.93%. So we're edging back from that 2% level. There's so much going on underneath, those headlines. So what's jumping out from your dashboard?
Yeah, I mean, what's jumping out from our dashboard is that, you know, the market is very clearly starting to shift towards pricing in this sort of post-Omicron bounce dynamic we've been talking about in our research, very similar to the post-Delta bounce in economic activity, both in terms of duration and magnitude. And probably not going to get the same positivity we got out of the stock market and risk assets in the month of October, but certainly we're well on our way to looking like we might begin some of it.
Yeah. So the big question is it sustainable though, right? Is this a bounce and then we're headed for a leg lower, or does it feel like this can kind of carry through for a bit?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's in terms of how we think about the world, one through the regime segmentation lens, but also through the lens of, you know, changes, impulses in policy, impulses in growth and inflation. And we really don't really get into a bearish concoction as it relates to those factors and those variables until you get into the springtime. And I would argue this sort of post-Omicron bounce dynamic may delay that by a month or two. So if you're a bear out there and you're looking to short stocks and you're looking to put on some volatility trades or you know, kind of CDX and all that sexy stuff to play for a big market decline, you're probably going to have to wait a couple of months just to kind of get this through the system.
You know, we have a big CPI number coming out tomorrow. I mean, inflation, the inflation narrative has really been dominating. Looking at your note today, you say inflation is tied with deflation. Walk us through what you're looking at there, because there's on two different ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, so those are the nomenclatures for our market regime outcasting process, or our grid regime process in general. And what inflation means is that the market is pricing in growth slowing with an inflationary bias. And what deflation means, the market is pricing in growth slowing with a disinflationary bias. And in terms of the markets that are signaling that, we sort of run our volatility adjusted momentum signal process across 42 markets in that model to determine what the dominant regime is. Those two markets are pricing are sort of kind of tied now in terms of the signals that they're getting or garnering rather. And so what that really tells you is that the market is confused on whether the direction of inflation right now. We're sort of, you know, the market's not too convinced that inflation is going to slow, but it's also not too convinced that it's going to continue to accelerate materially from here. But what it is convinced of, obviously, is that growth is likely to remain on its trend lower, irrespective of this sort of bounce that we are likely to see post-Omicron.
I want to pick up on that growth aspect in a moment, but the market's not the only one confused. The Fed is confused, it appears, as well. We had Atlanta Fed. We've been hearing from several of them this week. Atlanta Fed President Bostic today saying he's forecasting 3 hikes, could be 4, but he cautioned that it's going to have the central bank's just going to have to wait until they see how the economy responds. I sat down with Vincent Deleuard of StoneX yesterday, who said part of the calculation that they're going to need to do, that we're all going to need to do, is gauging consumer psyche. Have a listen to a clip of that.
I think they're still going to try to like maintain the myth that it's kind of, you know, slow down by the end of the year, but you can already see them kind of hedging their bets, at least for January, maybe February. And then I think they're just going to try, okay, like, let's hike rates, see what happens. And then we'll be in this kind of feedback loop between the two. But again, it takes time. I mean, if you look at prior hiking cycles, it takes at least 12 months for monetary policy to start having an effect on the real economy. And our timing for when this inflation is going to slow is, you know, I think if it doesn't slow within 4 or 5 months, then we have a problem. And one last thing I would mention, which is more on the psychological side, is that I would say that after a certain time, inflation is inflationary. Mm-hmm. The longer this lasts, the more people start to adjust their behavior. And it's not happening very quickly in the US because, again, we haven't seen inflation in 4 years, right? So most people are like, oh, you know, I'll just wait to buy, right? For example, used cars. Oh, I'd like to buy a car. I'm not going to buy a used car now. It's crazy, right? So you just wait. Like, oh, it's been a year. And like, at some point, your clunker is going to die, right? So you're going to have to buy. And then it could flip in your head. It's like, hold on. This thing keeps increasing. Like, if I keep waiting, I'm going to pay 20% more. And then you start pushing forward your purchases, which is the inflation expectation channel, which I don't think we've hit yet. But the longer we have this, you know, you go to a grocery store in New York or San Francisco, I mean, their entire shelves are empty. Like, it looks like some places, like a developing country. And the mentality, like, if it were Latin America, people would already be stockpiling stuff. It's only because we're in the U.S. where we have this kind of patience with inflation, but the more time passes, the more we're kind of eroding this capital.
Such a great point. And we also talked about where to find protection from short-term inflation pressures and the case for what Vincent calls active intangible investing. Really, really interesting conversation. The full interview is available on Essential Plus and Pro tiers. But yeah, sort of gauging consumer psychology, that's not easy, especially when we haven't been in an inflationary period in a really long time, Darius.
Yeah, so there's a myriad of ways to gauge consumer psychology. There's a ton of surveys. It's hard to pin down which survey to look at when. Just as a general rule of thumb, the Conference Board surveys here in the U.S. will give you a little bit more color on the labor market, or they were a little bit more sensitive to labor market dynamics, whereas the University of Michigan surveys tend to be a little bit more sensitive to inflation dynamics. But taking it to the Conference Board surveys, I would tend to agree with Vincent's general take that there are second round impacts of inflation. Second order effects on inflation that are really just a function of the time you spend in an inflationary environment. And what I mean by that is I think we're starting to see evidence of that. If you put up this chart I sent where we show the Conference Board's buying intention surveys, we normalize it to the month of October because the month of November is really where the inflation narrative really changed. If you go back to that October CPI print that we got, I want to say on November 10th or something like that, that's, you know, that one that jumped up to 6.9%. It really kind of caused the Fed to do an about face and drop the transitory language out of its forward guidance. That print was, you know, really since that print, we've seen an increase in consumer buying intentions in automobiles, consumer buying intentions in homes, major appliances, and consumer intentions on going on vacation. And I'll say two things. One, that's incongruent with the consumer spending data we've received since then. It's actually gone down and contracted pretty considerably in the month of December. But that's neither here nor there for this point. The real point is that, hey, look, consumers are now responding to this persistency of inflation in terms of, sort of chasing goods and services at a faster pace because they ultimately realize that their incomes, which are declining on a real basis and have been for several months, may not be able to buy them as much purchasing power as they thought they would months ago.
Hey, everyone, we're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Let's go back to the growth part of your equation, and that's concerning. So, in either scenario, you see a slowdown in growth. You know, when will we see that? How bad will it be? Because you don't get the sense that's fully priced in yet, or priced in at all.
No, not at all. I mean, the various pockets of the markets are very clearly far from their all-time highs, and very much likely not to recover their all-time highs. And I think the sort of, if you think about how markets typically peak, right, it's a series of sort of rolling capitulations, if you will, in terms of different sectors and style factors giving up the ghost. And in our opinion, that's exactly what we're experiencing now and what we're likely to continue to experience until this whole thing blows. So we're very negative on the growth outlook, certainly relative to consensus. Bloomberg consensus still has U.S. GDP for 2022 coming in at 3.8%, which is 160 basis points north of the five-year trend line through 2019, so the trend we were on prior to COVID. I think there's a lot of sort of explaining. They have a lot of economists at these Wall Street banks have a lot of explaining to do with respect to those forecasts. And the reason I say that is, one, we're going to see a near record fiscal contraction this year. We've been talking about that since going back to the fall. We're obviously going to see a considerable amount of monetary tightening this year. But then when you actually start to look at the data, the consumer intention, you know, sort of the, some of the data that would lead a big sort of consumer spending boom that obviously is priced into some of those growth expectations, whether you look at consumer sort of income expectations, we get that data through the Conference Board survey. You look at their expectations for improvement in the labor market, the diffusion indices therein, we get that from the Conference Board survey as well. And then we look at some of these sort of ancillary measures of consumer wellness and financial health. And pretty much everything you look at, it says consumers are concerned about, or their number one goals or their most important goals of this year are saving money for retirement, saving money, improving their financial health. At the same time, whether their outlook on the labor market is starting to deteriorate, and more importantly, their outlook on their own incomes is already deteriorating on a trending basis. Mm. And so when you put those three things together in the context of the fiscal monetary headwinds that we're likely to observe, I find it preposterous that investors can sit there with a straight face and say we're going to have an above trend growth year this year.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Should we believe those surveys and what consumers say? Because, you know, I say my most important thing is to save and pay down debt and do all the fiscally responsible things. But, you know, American consumers have a reputation of, the one thing that you can count on is they're going to spend. Maybe they spend less, maybe they spend more, but they're spenders. Do you think that's changed?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, what's changed is that they don't have any money.
Yeah.
You can't spend money you don't have. And look, this showed up in a major way in the December personal consumptions expenditure data. That's the broadest measure of consumer spending we get in the U.S. economy on a headline basis that contracted at a 12% annualized pace in December. I mean, that's crazy. And what's really happening underneath the hood is that we've created a boom in the goods economy. You know, goods demand and goods consumption was considerably north of its trend line prior to COVID, considerably north of that trend growth rate, that trend level. Now we're starting to give a lot of give back to that, and it's having impact in the economy. The goods consumption on a real basis declined or contracted, crashed at a minus 32% pace in the month of December. Now, you could write it off and say there was pull forward in terms of holiday spending, and I would tend to agree. We certainly saw that in the sort of October data. Didn't necessarily see it in the November data, but the real key takeaway is that, look, people just going to run out of stuff to buy, right? You're not going to buy six houses. You're not going to go out, you're not going to, buy six cars. You're not going to buy 10 washing machines and two dryers, like that. At some point that cycle comes to a head. And the issue for the economy this year, and this is why I continue to believe the big risk for 2022 in terms of market repricing, is that we could potentially have a growth scare in terms of the speed of the deceleration back to the trend. In the context of this services sector boom not materializing. And that the reason for that is because we're already showing a pretty considerable pace back towards the trend in goods consumption, potentially even through trend, right? If people pull forward a lot of these purchases from future years. And so I think, if we don't get this services sector boom, it could be look out below for growth expectations and ultimately look out below for risk assets.
So let's get to some questions. This is from Goncalo on the exchange. Darius, I know you're calling for deflation in the next months, and you can tell us whether that's true based on the fact that the market's confused between inflation and deflation. I know you're calling for deflation in the next months. Is that possibly going to occur with rising energy prices, and will that sort of transfer to the economy? Could that feed into that growth scare that you're worried about?
Well, it's already asked that into the growth scare, right? With consumer incomes, if you look at real disposable personal income on a per capita basis, it's contracted at a 3% annualized pace in the month of December. Now, we've had some pretty squirrely numbers throughout the pandemic as a function of all the fiscal stimulus in here and there and taking and giving. But the reality is, ex-pandemic, that would be a recessionary number. right? Like that's a pretty big deal, and to have consumer spending, real disposable personal income per capita contracting at that pace. And it really just goes to show how much inflation is really taking a bite out of consumer purchasing power. The one thing I would address in the question, you know, I think I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, it's very likely that high frequency data bottom in the month of January and accelerate, you know, at least over the next couple of months, like here in February, most likely. And then certainly by the month of March, we'll see a pretty market acceleration off those January lows. Whether or not that bounces to be sustained is up for debate. We would argue it's very unlikely to be sustained well into the spring. If anything, you might get at most, you know, 2 to 3 months of an acceleration off of these Omicron-driven January lows. And then from that point forward, it's very much likely we return to this trend of deceleration we've been on since the second quarter of last year.
So Basking Turtle on YouTube is asking, what are the possible catalyst signals for the end of a post-Omicron bounce and the realization of that deflationary regime?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is stuff, I mean, by the way, everything I say is obviously being published in our research on a regular basis. So come check that out at 42macro.com. So one thing we publish on every day are the two signals. So we call, there's sort of the two sows of assessing market risk in terms of whether or not you need to make major portfolio changes. There's sort of your sudden stop risk, like something happened, we need to get out of this burning movie theater quick. And then I think there's a guy in the back of the movie theater playing with matches. And so we call that rolling stop risk. From a sudden stop risk perspective, we sort of anchor on our volatility adjusted momentum signals and what we call our four horsemen of market risk. These are intra-market indicators that tell you whether or not the market is pivoting towards risk on and risk off. That'd be the VVIX-VIX ratio, the high beta, low beta ratio, small cap, mega cap ratio, and the value to growth ratio. When three of those four ratios are signaling are bearish from that perspective and making lower lows, that typically is a warning sign that the market is about to go no bid. So right now we're not there yet in terms of meeting those signals. And I would suspect we're actually going to get less close to hitting that signal in the ensuing weeks as a function of this post-Omicron bounce dynamic. And then there's two, the rolling stop risk. Let's say post-Omicron bounce catalyzes some positivity in asset markets over the next couple of weeks or maybe even a couple of months. You know, I'm sympathetic to it potentially lasting a couple of months, although I don't feel the need to make the call on that. The reality is you're going to start to see market internals really start to transition back towards defensive. And so it's one of the other analysis we look at is our dispersion analysis, where we're trying to identify extremes in leadership and more importantly, extremes in flows into and out of various sectors and style factors. And right now, those extremes and flows don't necessarily say the market is ready for a big drawdown. So investors have some time in terms of if they want to, you know, kind of if they're shorter term risk managers, they can take advantage of a post-Omicron bounce and being long things like, you know, pure reflation plays, cyclicals and things of that nature. That's certainly something that would seem to be supported by our near-term outlook. But if you're not that kind of investor and you're someone who doesn't have the ability or doesn't want to pay to have the ability to actually time that exit, then you're probably better off doing what we would, our research would suggest you do for the balance of this year, which is maintain a defensive exposure. You know, take down your overall beta in your portfolio, your overall volatility to certain assets, your overall correlation to certain asset classes and high volatile, high beta risk assets. You know, continue to buy bonds tactically, build up that position, build up some cash buffers. Because again, I meant no words about this. The conditions are there for a 20 to 30, potentially 50% market decline.
In equities.
Yeah, the conditions are there. Now, you'd be a fool if you're sitting in my seat, you know, making calls like that. I think it's unnecessary to make calls like that. But the conditions are there through a variety of lenses: growth, monetary policy, fiscal policy, investor positioning. I mean, there's a lot of different sort of stools to the bear case that are very underappreciated by market participants, at least according to my discussions with the institutional investors.
Yeah, that's flashing a massive warning sign. Absolutely. So I think this speaks to James' question on the exchange. What are your thoughts regarding shorting the QQQs?
Yeah, so
puts out to mid-year.
I would go beyond mid-year. I think that the party might get started by mid-year, certainly by, in our opinion, by May. I think you're going to start to run out of steam on any post-Omicron bounce dynamic by the month of April at the latest. Maybe it's even shallower than that. Again, if we were, if there wasn't this sort of lofty growth expectation out there, I would be significantly less bearish. You know, and again, let me take that back. Bearish is not a useful word. I would be less concerned about overall market risk. That is a more useful way of saying about this. The issue, in my opinion, and the reason why you could have this post-Omicron bounce dynamic actually materialize in markets is because growth expectations remain fairly robust. We are seeing supply chain disruptions starting to ease a bit. So there is a community of investors out there that are naturally inclined to be bullish on stocks, be bullish on credit, and just be generally long of risk assets in general. They're going to look around and say, hey, look, well, things are still fine. The Fed's got a long way to go to tighten policy back to a neutral policy setting. So let's buy this dip and take advantage of it. And those people are likely to be rewarded, because when you look at things like the AAII bull bear survey, it got to an extreme point in recent weeks. And typically what you find is there's a bullish resolution to that stuff, but it tends not to be, you know, lasting. And so the reality is, you know, sentiment did get very blown out to the bear side in January. And that's partially why, you know, we were very content not to sell the lows in January, as a lot of investors did. Let's not forget, someone had to sell the lows, otherwise we wouldn't have seen them. The reality is you could continue to see that lift as a function of some investors kind of checking off some boxes on their more micro-oriented fundamental views.
Right. You know, I'm glad you brought up the supply chain, because that is the kind of thing where if you were to see improvement, that you could understand, or that would sort of create this feeling like, combined with the fact that the mask mandates are falling, the supply chains are easing, okay, like, you know, it's go time. And you point out one indicator that you're watching, which is very interesting, Japanese machine orders. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, so that number came out this morning. So that, in our opinion, is arguably the best hard data statistic to monitor as it relates to the global industrial cycle. That chart there is the red line is the machine tool orders growth rate overlay with the OECD composite leading index time series for the global economy. And as you can see, it's more or less, you know, the same time series. And so that bounce that we saw in Japan, Japanese machine tool orders in the month of January is, in our opinion, indicative of this post-Omicron bounce dynamic. You know, it's very like, so this is a leading indicator for growth. And so over the next couple of months, it's very likely we see, you know, other, you know, high frequency growth data, PMIs, sort of confidence measures, kind of unthawed a bit from their January lows. And so that's what that's telling you.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
What would sort of argue for you to get, what would you be watching or looking for you to feel a little bit more constructive on the growth outlook? Because, you know, clearly you see a marked slowdown after we get that kind of head fake of everything reopening. What would change your scenario? What is something that you're watching for as sort of the outlier? Like, okay, hang on a minute. Maybe the economy can withstand some of these more negative factors of higher interest rates, et cetera.
Yeah, great question. So as you know, we're about as data dependent as any research provider on Wall Street. I make no bones about that statement. So we're very glued to all the data. We obviously run very sophisticated models that are now casting all these dynamics. The number one thing, in my opinion, that we should all be focused on are two things. Number one would be real income growth. Is real income growth bottoming and starting to reaccelerate, or are consumers continue to be cash constrained and unable to sort of, you know, kind of lift the offer on a lot of these sort of goods and services that are out there. And then number two, does consumer confidence materially improve in a way that would suggest that we actually are on a precipice of some sort of post-pandemic spending boom? Right now, consumer confidence is at a 10-year low, right? Like, you look at the University of Michigan survey, and part of that reason it's at a 10-year low is because inflation expectations are at a, you know, near 15-year high, and consumer sort of financial, their assessment of their own kind of financial conditions is actually at a multi-year low, I think, going back to 2014. And so, like, you know, this is, consumers are feeling the pinch of inflation. And right now, the, you know, investors are doing their best to try to take advantage of being long of inflation in asset markets. But ultimately, as that growth dynamic really starts to come under question, and again, there's no reason for it to come under question for the next couple of months. There's no, we're not going to get any data that suggests growth is slowing at a material pace, potentially back to and through its trend, until we get into the springtime, at least according to our models. So that, in our opinion, you know, that's when you want to be kind of looking and confirming data that either agrees with that view or disconfirms that view at the margin. And that's what we do every day at 42 Macro.
So is this why you're saying in your note that the kind of reflation trades exposure to things like emerging industrial materials are set to force investors off the cliff? That's what that was your language. That seems pretty scary.
Yeah, no, look, I go back to it. Like, again, you look at it from the lens of growth, the deltas on growth, the impulse on growth. You look at it through the lens of the impulse on monetary tightening, particularly with respect to the Fed's balance sheet. You look at it through the lens of the impulse on fiscal policy. And then you look at it through the sort of dynamics associated with positioning and the household balance sheet. All four of those impulses, at least going back to the crashes and market cycles we've studied, going as far back as we can get the data, all four of those things are independently saying stocks could be down on S&P terms 20% at some point this year. Now, I would argue the liquidity conditions in financial markets are significantly worse than they've been in recent years. So what you think might be 20%, it could easily very well be 30% or something like that. Obviously, you're talking about like a 60-70% decline in something like Bitcoin. But going back to this chart, what we're showing in this chart, so this chart is our crowding analysis. What we're doing is trying to identify extremes in derivatives positioning to take advantage of sort of the, you know, near-term market risk. And what we're showing on the x-axis is this the one-year z-score and two-month 25 delta skew. The y-axis is showing the volatility risk premium, the near-term volatility risk premium in these various assets. And what you typically find, you know, are assets that are sort of poised to squeeze shorts and rally and have these sort of ferocious bounce tend to have elevated skew relative to the trend and elevated near-term volatility risk premium. And that unwind of that excess positioning tends to perpetuate some positivity. And so one thing we called our note this morning, and we actually called this out going back last week as well, we said, hey, look, and this was last week, we said high beta and high yield, they're set up to squeeze investors. And that's obviously exactly what we got. And this morning, as you can see in the title of this chart, it's saying, hey, look, a lot of these pure reflation exposures, the kinds of places you'd want to be on this sort of post-pandemic, post-Omicron, pandemic transitioning to an endemic phase type recovery are actually sort of, you know, kind of at extreme bearish positioning, you know, if you think about it from a near-term perspective in the options market. And so if you wanted to take advantage of that, that the trade is right there in front of you, that you can go put that on and get long of these types of exposures. Now, the problem is if you don't subscribe, you're probably not going to get the look-see on when to sell those things as well, because those are exactly the types of exposures you don't want to be long if we're talking about going into a more material risk-off deflation-style market that we ultimately expect to materialize by the middle of the year.
Yeah, and this is where timing is going to be so critical. We have a question from Bonnie on the RV site. How does the lead-up to the midterm elections play into your analysis?
I think it already happened, to be quite frank. I mean, we made this call back in early November when we got that October CPI print. We said, hey, look, there's no more fiscal stimulus coming. Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema are now in protect their own seat mode as opposed to sort of protect the Biden administration mode. So I don't think the midterms will have much of an impact. If anything, it probably makes this whole thing worse, right? Because you're going to have people on the side of the right, the Republicans are definitely going to say, hey, look, these bozos can't run the country. They got, you know, you're filling it at the pump, you're filling it at the grocery store, you're filling it on rent because, you know, these guys can't get anything done. And so in our opinion, that discussion, that debate, that narrative out there, that'll be extremely loud heading into the midterm elections, in our opinion, puts the Fed in a box. I mean, the Fed is already in a box, right? And this is part of the reason we're so negative, is we're not just negative on, you know, these sort of impulse dynamics and positioning dynamics from a medium term perspective, although I would argue plenty enough there to get you bearish. The reason we think there's a lot of market risk this year, and I've been saying this on the program since going back probably the summer of last year, say, look, there's going to be a time next year, and this is now, we're in the year next year now, there's going to be a time where growth is decelerating at a potentially scary pace, where the Fed is out the lunch with respect to policy rate tightening, and the Fed is out the lunch with respect to contracting its balance sheet. There's no off-ramp for the Fed for several quarters. There's going to be no signal from the labor market that they need to stop doing what they're doing. There's going to be no signal from the level of inflation that they need to stop doing what they're doing, at least not according to our projections on inflation, at least for another year or so. And so the only feedback loop the Fed can potentially receive is going to come through the lens of financial conditions. And obviously, as investors, the bull case can't be the Fed's going to pivot if the stock market's down 30%, right? That's not a bull case. That's a buy the dip case. But the bull, you know. So to me, I think that the market is in for potential, world of hurt as it tries to discover where the strike price of the Fed put is. In our opinion, it's 20-30% lower.
And you know, do you think that the Fed will sort of err on the favor of trying to get that inflation down and let the stock market go down as much as 30%? Do you think they'll choose inflation over asset markets?
Yeah, but by the time the stock market is down 30%, the Fed will very much pivot to being easy again, because it'll be pretty clear through the lens of financial conditions that we're on a path towards something that is a lot worse than having bad inflation. And it's talking about, you know, a slowdown well beyond trend in terms of growth. And again, let's, you know, a couple other stats, you know, while we're still here, you know, I think it's very likely that we're, one thing we're talking about that by the end of the year that we're not talking about right now is, you know, sort of a potential recession next year. You know, not anything that's scary like the great financial crisis, something that looks more like 2001, where you have this sort of overbuild of productive capacity that's chasing a goods consumption boom that, in our opinion, was not sustainable, was obviously inflated as a function of a lot of the pandemic stimulus that we got. And a couple of data points to sort of lend credence to this developing view, because it's not quite there yet. We don't have enough data to really put the stake in the ground there. The last two GDP reports, inventory builds accounted for 96% of the headline GDP in Q3 and 71% of headline GDP in Q4. Those are really high numbers. You know, so it's telling you that they were starting to see this inventory build into what I believe, into what we believe at 42 Macro, is an unsustainable level of goods consumption, as evidenced by the most recent data. And so, in our opinion, there's a lot of mismatch out there with respect to where we see the economy headed, where we see Fed policy headed over the next few quarters, and ultimately sort of the positioning dynamics within the market. So, could be a tale of two halves, if you will.
All right. Well, certainly a lot for us to think on there, Darius. Thank you so much, as always, for all of that excellent insight. We appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for watching as well, as always, and for the fantastic questions. Ash will be back tomorrow with Tommy Thornton, so be sure to tune in. As always, the conversation continues on the exchange on our website. So in the meantime, take care and good luck out there.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.